The Guardian.
Football Weekly Extra.
Today, Munchen drama. Guardiola fails to read English papers properly, signs for Bayern by mistake. Punchen drama. Chelsea's home woes continue as Jason and Saints stage historic comeback at the Bridge. And luncheon drama. Chelsea face Arsenal next Sunday lunchtime. We look ahead to that on Football Weekly Extra and all the Premier League action this weekend, where there's Man United at Spurs and the West Midlands derby, and also in South Africa as the Cup of Nations begins. Floating brain o' fun, Jonathan Wilson runs his Ja Rule over the contenders. All of that and more in today's Football Weekly Extra. Yes, it's true. Jonathan Wilson joining us today on the pod, but not for long, Jonathan.
No, I've got to fly, quite literally.
Right, you're off to South Africa today.
Yes, later this afternoon.
Cool. What are you packing?
Shirt, trousers, underwear, socks, a cafetiere, because coffee in South Africa is abysmal.
Is that so?
Yeah, it was. I found a difficult World Cup, mainly because the coffee is so extraordinarily weak. South Africa, you have a lovely country in some ways. Your coffee is appalling.
Right. That had sort of long been the issue with South Africa. Philippe Auclair's also here, Philippe.
Hello.
Hi, bonjour.
Bonjour. Where? Is there something as a coffee test? The better the coffee, the worse the country is.
Ooh.
Jonathan.
Where
does that
South
leave
Africa
France,
brilliant.
Do you think?
It varies in France.
Does it?
Yeah, a lot.
Argentinian coffee, I think, is very variable. Okay. I mean, you really get the highs and the lows on the same street.
Right, well, we're saving all of this for part three. But Owen Gibson's also here.
Hello there, hi.
Hi, Owen.
Coffee in the Guardian office is reliably awful.
Well,
that is true. That is definitely true.
Oh, there you go. Hey, but listeners, enough of our problems. Let's talk about Chelsea. Let's talk about their problems. Owen Gibson, oh dearie me.
Yep.
Chelsea-Southampton, their game in hand, their chance to ease a little bit closer to Man City at the top. What happened?
It goes way beyond coffee, doesn't it, the problems at Stamford Bridge. I mean, again, it was just...
Although there's grounds involved in both cases.
again, it's a dreadful atmosphere by all accounts. You know, the edginess, the twitchiness started, the insults start raining down from the stands again. I mean, Torres booed again when he came on.
He was awful.
But bringing on Torres for Lampard is almost provocative by Benitez, isn't it? I mean, it's almost like he's trying to provoke them, and they're all coming on the same day as Guardiola, of course. Almost inevitable that a comeback like that would provoke that reaction from the stands.
Well, it was interesting because the game started with this notion that Pep's decision to go to Bayern, which we'll talk much more about later on, had made Rafa a little bit less interim than he was at the start of the day, and there weren't any boos particularly coming out. The chant of only one Di Matteo at 16 minutes wasn't that loud. And then Chelsea had a two-goal lead going into half-time, and given the fact they'd beaten Southampton 5-1 in their last meeting, you thought this is all sorted. But then... Nigel Atkins remembered he had Ricky Lambert on the bench, brought him on, he scored within minutes.
Indeed, that completely changed the game, and all of a sudden, the sort of jitters set in, and then, you know, Chelsea under Benitez, and to an extent under Di Matteo, don't seem able to close out games in the way that they obviously used to in previous eras, and they don't necessarily seem, again, you know, it's a well-worn topic, but they don't seem to have the characters necessarily that can see them through, you know, when they're not playing so well, or when they go through a tough period in the game, can close it out.
An extraordinary stat for you. Prior to yesterday's game, 89 times Chelsea had been leading 2-0 at halftime in the Premier League. Of those 89, they had won 87, drawn 1, lost 1.
Norwich, 1993.
Absolutely right. Do you know the other one?
No.
Neither can I remember. Never mind.
But that was the famous one when Ian Porterfield came out and slaughtered Dave Besson afterwards.
That's right, yeah.
There you go. 23 kids says Benitez has a worse record at Stamford Bridge than Harold Hardrada. Yay, we like that one.
I don't quite understand the switch of the Stamford Bridge crowd from "We love you, Fernando," and literally holding on onto any occasion of singing his name when he was misfiring, and now booing him.
Well, it's something quite interesting about the psychology of crowds, isn't it? I think partly it's the fact that Benitez was brought in to coax form out of Torres, and now he's sort
guilt
of...
Guilt by association.
He's tainted by association
but
with
also,
Benitez.
But also, is it not the fact that Torres was all they had?
I'm trying to get my brain around that, because I don't think it quite works, logically.
Well, of course it doesn't. It's a football crowd.
Exactly. That's true,
exactly.
Okay. Sorry.
There's no logic involved, but no, I think that's partly it, and it's also partly that Chelsea fans are now just
We support Torres when he's not scoring. We sing his name. When he's trying hard, okay. Then a manager comes in and plays him, and actually the guy starts scoring again a bit.
A bit.
A bit. So therefore we boo him.
No, they hate Benitez.
I think there's a couple of things here. One,
I'm being a bit disingenuous. No, but only a bit.
He started scoring, but then when Barr came in and they saw how easy it was with Barr, and Barr immediately scores a couple of goals against Southampton. Mm-hmm. The booing, I think, of Torres really started when, for the next game, Barr wasn't started
was
and Torres
Swansea
wasn't
game,
in his
and
place.
Swansea and Torres, to be fair, apparently had this stomach bug, which nobody knew about beforehand, but he looked completely listless, looked like he wasn't trying at all. And I think that's the point, particularly on top of the Benitez stuff, at which the fans turned because they felt he was no longer trying. Where there was, you're right, there was sort of almost perverse level of support for him before that.
Hmm. Well, one win in seven Premier League home games is Chelsea's least productive run since April 1995. Jonathan, as you're well aware. Next up, they have Arsenal at Stamford Bridge on Sunday. Hmm. An Arsenal team. Is there a new dawn breaking over the Emirates?
I thought they were very good. I mean, certainly... Well, actually, no, the whole game, the second half particularly last night, I thought they looked a lot more energetic, a lot more focused than they had done against City on Sunday.
And Wilshere looks like he's getting back to the player he was before his injury, doesn't he?
Yeah, and he sort of had that sense that you'd get certain players who, when the goal isn't arriving when you're on top, or when you suddenly need the momentum of the game shifting, can grab hold of it almost by force of personality. And I think you saw that... Yeah, he became increasingly involved in the second half of what went on. He became increasingly involved in forward areas, and it was no great surprise that he was the one who got the breakthrough.
Mm. And as these things ebb and flow through the season, it's quite interesting. But obviously, you know, with Wilshere coming back to form, with Walcott finally almost signing his contract, you know, you feel like things are coming together a little bit again for Wenger.
Well, it was a 1-0 win, eventually.
Yeah,
loads of Arsenal chances against Swansea in the third-round replay.
There were about half a dozen clearances off the line. So I can remember Britton doing it.
Graham,
Mitchell Vorm actually had yet again another very, very fine game. It was a bit Jack of the Rovers, really. I mean, this stuff... Roy of the Rovers, Jack of the Rovers.
Yeah,
blah,
that
blah,
was the little node sequel. Yeah,
yeah. But I think there are also reasons why this Arsenal team looked far more dynamic than it has almost at any time since the beginning of the season. And one of the reasons is that it was, and for once, differently organised. A different type of players. They've played with Arteta and Wilshere in front of the back four, and Arteta, for all his qualities, tends to slow down the game quite a bit. He plays laterally. There they had Francis Coquelin, who is a very dynamic kind of player, and Abu Diaby, who is also a player who likes to go forward, and actually did so with some success, which means that Wilshere was playing in the position which is suggested by the shirt he has on his back. He was playing as true number 10 yesterday, and he really looked very, very good in that role.
All right. Well, a big game came up against Chelsea, who did win at the Emirates when they clashed there.
The one thing is that from the word go, you could feel it was a different Arsenal side. The tempo was completely different. The passing was much quicker. The movement, there was far more movement of front. Was it a question of personnel? Was it a question of Wenger sitting down and trying to understand what's gone wrong in the
past
few
weeks? Was it a question
of
facing Swansea, who gave them a bit of room to play?
Well, they played Swansea not that long ago, and I don't remember that performance at the Emirates has been one of their best.
But I mean, I think it's significant that Wenger on Sunday, the first thing he said in the press conference, you know, he dismissed talk about the penalty and the sending off.
Yeah.
I went straight in with, we weren't aggressive enough early on, we didn't have any authority early on, we had no personality early on. So it would follow that he had worked on that, and you know, the benefits were clear.
All right. Well, there's also been talk of Wenger spending a bit of money. Rumours of Diame coming across from, I'm pronouncing it your way, from the West
Ham. Yeah, that wouldn't cost much money.
Right. And is that going to happen, do you think, Philippe?
Let's put it that way. I've heard little rumours and ramblings coming from the Diame camp that make me think that there is some genuine interest in there.
All right, also...
And for this amount of money, 3.5 million, it would be a very good catch, yes. Yeah.
Right, just going back to the Harold Hardrada Stamford Bridge angle. Jonathan, do you want to do this?
Harold II, 1066, took an army north to Yorkshire to fight the Danes, the Norsemen. And although he won that, as we know, in those days, squad rotations were very difficult. Squad sizes weren't what they are now. They had to travel back south and had another very difficult fixture against the Normans, who of course were Norsemen originally as well, weren't they?
Yeah, but they'd been eating camel bear for two centuries.
But Harold Hardrada, because Normandy,
very good away from home.
Normandy means land of the Norsemen. Is
absolutely.
That right? Yeah. Is that where you're from, Normandy?
Yeah, I'm a Nordmund.
There you go.
My grandmother is Trude, which means Teroldus or Tor.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's Norman and a half, isn't it?
Right. But Harold Hardrada, because Ben's still waiting to find out. Harold Hardrada was basically
he was the
Leo
Danish
Messi
leader
of his day, basically. He'd fought all over the wall, all over the world, which in those days was quite, you know, transfers weren't so easy, etc.
It was the Michael Laudrup of his era.
All right.
Perhaps.
Yeah, okay, in a managerial sense, because he'd gone over, I think he'd fought in Byzantium and all that kind of thing. And he'd been drafted back in by the son of King Canute, who wanted to reclaim...
That's right, yeah. It was a very complicated thing, because King Canute, I think, had three sons who all wanted
Nigerian.
Right.
He was more with David Beckham of his ear then, wasn't he?
Right. Sort
of,
you know, more the David Beckham. Right. Yeah. Anyway, so, and then he basically, and he defended Stamford Bridge until somebody went under the bridge. This is Harold Hardrada, who was basically the non... But he was the Optimus Prime of his day, basically. And somebody snuck under the bridge and stuck a sword up quite literally into and that's how that finished, and that's why we're all Normans.
One thing, of course, because we're all talking about, you know, like Chelsea, Benitez, yes, Arsenal, maybe, so this is it's actually an absolutely crucial game for the Premier League as a whole. This, if you look at the classification, it will have a huge impact on the top four, this one, the Chelsea, Arsenal. Something perhaps which is not talked about, because we all think about the problems that each club has at the moment, but Chelsea, especially after the tour against Southampton, you look at it...
Well, they're still 2 points clear of Spurs, but Arsenal are 6 points away. One game in hand. But games in hand, as Chelsea know, don't always go the way you expect them. Tell you what, before we finish off part one, can we talk about another crucial game on Sunday, which sees Man United, who are 7 points clear at the top of the table, visiting White Hart Lane. Am I crazy to think that this could be where United come a cropper?
No, I don't think you are crazy. But I think, or at least the draw is certainly eminently possible, isn't it? At which point, and you'd see Man City winning this weekend, so the gap could narrow. And I think that's one of the reasons why everyone's saying that obviously it's crazy to write City off at this stage, even though they haven't had a particularly outstanding season. They're still there or thereabouts, and, you know, obviously last season we saw them close that gap. So
absolutely, when Liverpool attacked in the last 20 minutes against United looked shaky. Do you think Tottenham will go for it from the off?
Yeah, I think they will, and I think Tottenham are playing really well. I saw Sunderland play City on Boxing Day, and I saw them play Spurs on the 29th, and the difference between the two opponents to Sunderland was enormous. And I think the strange thing with Tottenham, I saw them a bit early in the season, and the Norwich game in particular was clear that they really struggled to get people up from midfield to support the forward. And what's happened by bringing in Lloris, because he's so comfortable coming out of this box, because he's so comfortable with his feet, way more than Friedel, who for all his qualities as a keeper tends to stay back. It means the back four can push higher, and that means they can play tight to the midfield can push higher, and that means that automatically the team is much more compact. So that issue of not getting support forward has paradoxically been solved by changing the goalkeeper.
But they're going to miss Sandro, aren't they? I mean, he's out.
Well, who is a huge loss. Yeah, that's true.
Absolutely. Will Vidic be back for the game?
Well, I think Ferguson was talking in terms of probably. I don't think it's certain, yeah. But I think he and Young aren't as badly injured as was first feared. Mm. And it is just bruising with Vidic. So I think, given how much better they look when Vidic is there, I think he probably will be risked. But I actually still think Tottenham will win that.
All right. Well, that's part one for you. Coming up after this, Guardiola.
This week on the Guardian Audio Edition. Mali, high stakes in Hollande's war, Johnny Margot solo, and our audiobook review looks at Christopher Priest's The Islanders and Daniel Defoe's classic Robinson Crusoe. To subscribe for free, go to audible.co.uk/Guardian or find us on SoundCloud and iTunes. The Guardian Audio Edition, a new way to get the whole picture.
Right, part two, breaking news. Well, those poor tabloids, he took them and he led them up the garden path with that cheeky Catalan grin on his face, Pep Guardiola. Instead, he's off to Bayern Munich, and Johnny is now on the line, Raphael Honigstein. Rafa.
How are you?
I'm all right. How are you, Raphael?
Not too bad.
Ka-ching. That's how you are.
Yeah.
Hey.
Yeah. I love you, Pep.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Vindication.
The news coming out, the rumours coming out of Munich were very, very strong at the beginning of the week and effectively forced Bayern to declare their hand much earlier than they wanted to, because the deal, as we know now, has been in place before Christmas. But ideally, they would have liked to have kept the secret for at least another couple of months. But they couldn't, because as soon as the speculation got so ripe, they couldn't let this interfere with the rest of the season, which of course just kicks off again this weekend for Bayern.
Well, you mentioned the fact that they wanted to keep it Sturm, as they say. How will, do you think, the fact that Guardiola is now sitting in the wings waiting, how will that affect the team for the rest of this season under your Pikes?
It's very, very difficult to predict. I think that the overall effect will probably be negligible, simply because most people, including the players in the dressing room, were probably under the opinion, or they knew that Jupp Heynckes was going to call it a day at the end of the season. So that sort of lame duck scenario that people like to talk about didn't really arise. And in any effect, Bayern are doing so well chasing the treble this season that I don't think they need a manager to sort of jump up and down before each game telling them what to do. They're a pretty well-oiled machine, and if anything, I think the Pep story has made them look forward to next season and just gave a bit of a seal of approval as far as the ambition of the club is concerned.
All right. Why do you think he chose Bayern?
I think from the two really big offers on the table, this one fitted much better for him. The other one was Chelsea. Of course, it would have been more lucrative. But I think Bayern fits in with what he wants to do, fits in with his ideas. They're a club not too dissimilar to Barcelona in the way they're set up, in the way that the club works, in the way that the youth system works, in the way that it's sort of an iconic club that's hated and loved in almost equal fashion in Germany, that really polarizes opinion straight down the middle.
It's more than a club,
yeah. Yeah, well, I wouldn't go that far, but it is a pretty big institution, shall we say, in a sort of a place that stands for the whole of Bavaria and for part of Germany. But also, I think, you know, looking forward, as far as his career is concerned, of course, going to Bayern still protects or keeps all his options open. Mm. And I think that in 3 years' time, when his contract is up, he'll probably have a look around and see if one or two options that perhaps fit his ideas better than Chelsea in the Premier League will be open to him, and we'll see what happens then.
All right. Well, this is only his second club that he's going to be managing. His first one, in some ways, was a bit of a dream setup, working with the pool of talent that he had. How do you think it's going to work? Do you think he's going to be a success at Bayern?
Well, it's a similar setup. It's just as dreamy a setup. In many ways, people are saying, oh, it's really the safe option because he's going to win lots of stuff. Well, with hindsight, you could say the same about the Barcelona with Messi, but it's, I think, easy to forget just how washed up the Barcelona of Rijkaard were before he took over. Now he's starting arguing from a better, from a stronger position with Bayern. The stakes are very high. He can only lose in terms of not winning the Champions League because everything else was almost taken as a given. So it's a very comfortable job as far as almost guaranteeing domestic trophies, although Dortmund might disagree. But it's a difficult job because his real work, or the real job he has to do, is to take a very, very good team and make it no less than the best team in the world. And I think that's going to be really difficult.
Sarah in here, Rafa. I mean, I thought it was interesting the point you made in your piece this morning about the fact that the machinery around him is all in place as it was in Barcelona, so he can pretty much concentrate on the football side. That obviously wouldn't have been the case at some of the other offers he had on the table. I mean, do you think that was quite seductive in a way as well, that he can pretty much just concentrate on the football and not the politics?
Yeah, I think, you know, when you look at this, the way he was in the Barcelona job, looking quite tired towards the end of it, always just renewing for another year, looking really like he could take on a little bit less in terms of responsibility. The one thing that really at Bayern you don't have to do is basically manage the whole club and think about stadium down payments and wage structures and all that. You don't have to negotiate wages. You don't have to deal with agents. You just say, I like this player, or I don't like him, and somebody else will take care of it. And there's a sense of purity when it comes to coaching in this continental structure, because you are there as a coach, not necessarily as a manager. Of course, you know, when it works really well, the English is pretty unbeatable, as we've seen with Alex Ferguson. But it also, the kind of checks and balances and divisions of powers also work well when it comes to bringing stability to clubs. And I think with him in Barcelona, Bayern seems to be a better fit right now.
Nice one. Rafa, one final thing. How's the deal being greeted by the German press as a sign of the new sexiness of the Bundesliga?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, all the editorial pieces concentrate just how well this reflects on the league, how it really shows that the Bundesliga is up and coming and has a bit more clout now that it can get a guy like this who was very much in demand by everyone else. And I think, I suspect, even the people, even the fans who really very much dislike Bayern still feel a sense of pride that the Bundesliga has been able to attract such a guy. And of course, it sets up the next season almost beautifully, because there is, I think, a realization that this season Bayern will be unstoppable. But Dortmund looking very, very strong in terms of what they're doing in the transfer market. And next season, Klopp v Guardiola looks like a very, very exciting prospect.
Tell you what, in other top managerial news, how about Gordon Strachan going to Scotland? It's a good appointment, isn't it?
Well, I think it's significant that Guardiola only made the leap to go to Bayern after the Scotland job was taken. I think that was probably the one he was holding out for, and it must have been a great... I just hope he hasn't gone to Bayern on the rebound, that's all I'm saying.
David DeLarge says, Ferguson, Dalglish, Lambert, Moyes, Steve Clarke, surely none of these names would consider taking the Scotland job while they have jobs at Premier League clubs, or even the chance of one, which is why Strachan, has been out of work for 3 years, was the best they could do. Got me wondering, is there any other nation in world football which produces so many managers...
Nope.
Who consider themselves above the national team coaching position?
Well, I don't know. I mean, former Yugoslavia produces enormous numbers of coaches to coach abroad. Whether it's quite the same number as Scotland, at quite the same level, I'm not sure. But if you go, if you look at
to the population,
yeah,
I would say yes. I mean, I can't think of any other nation producing as many coaches of quality.
Mm. All right. In other news, 62 quid gate rumbles on. Pretty extraordinary. The linesman got dropped. And also, we've had Rich, who says, I'm an avid listener of the Football Weekly podcast and also a Met police press officer. I was at Arsenal Man City, and it was the club security who asked fans to take those banners down. They refused, and that's why officers came to the assistance of the club security to help prevent a breach of the peace.
Well, no matter how it happened, it still shouldn't have happened. It was clearly a PR own goal.
Yeah. He doesn't say what they would have been threatened with being arrested for.
Isn't there something weird at the Emirates that you can only put up banners that have been... The club sort of have to pre-vet them. Well, and their excuse is it's a fire certificate.
They have to it was a certain, of a certain size, I think. That's the excuse. FIFA
you can understand why the ground would want to check what... You see, in Italy they have this issue because of some of the banners that have been put up there, which is frankly obscene, and that therefore there is this capacity to take things down. But something about 62 quid, yeah. And now on the line we have Sid Lowe in
Hello,
Madrid.
James.
How are you doing?
I'm all right, thanks. How are you?
Good, Sid, good. Now, big story first of all. We're just hearing from Raphael Honigstein about the Guardiola to Bayern move. Were you caught by surprise?
Yes. Yeah, I was. Yeah, of course. But I was caught by surprise. This is going to sound contradictory, but by surprise in a way that I expected to. If that makes any sense at all.
Yep.
In that, when we've talked about this before, I've always said that somehow it felt to me like this wasn't going to end up with the obvious.
Right.
And yet, of course, when you go through it and you pick it apart, and yesterday I was speaking to someone. Oh, there goes a drill. Brilliant. Yesterday I was speaking to someone about Guardiola's mindset a little bit in terms of the decision making process. And when you pick it apart, it does have a certain logic to it.
I can't bear you being interrupted again, Sid. Really, do you think it's going to work, Sid?
Do I think it's going to work?
Yeah.
I suppose it depends how we're judging work. I mean, he's got a really good... Raph obviously knows this much better than me, but he's got a really, really good squad. I think he's got a club that has the structure that means that he can work almost certainly the way that he wants. I think he is a good manager. I think the assumption that it was easy at Barcelona just isn't true. But, of course, Barcelona was the perfect club for him. So, yeah, I think it will work in terms of, you know, I think they'll continue to be the strongest team in Germany. But is that enough for it to work? And I think he'll be successful, but of course, you know, so many small factors can be involved, and yeah, I think the logical conclusion would be that this is a side that probably will reach, you know, let's say for argument's sake, over the next 3 years, perhaps three Champions League semi-finals, something mm-hmm. like that.
All right, well, a couple of posters with questions for you relating to Guardiola. 23 kid in part two of his post says, will Pep want to sign some Barca players to help mould Bayern to his philosophy, and would they be tempted to go there?
I love this fact. Someone was on the radio last night here in Spain. We phoned up a correspondent for one of the German TV channels here in Spain, and he made the point that he reckoned that Bayern Munich currently have in the bank, in other words, money that's readily available. So I think it was 278 million euros, and I thought, that's enough to pay Leo Messi's buyout clause. Wow. So there you go, Leo Messi. Now, I personally think he probably won't go back to Barca and take players. I think he'll be very conscious that if he does go and take players from there, it will be in agreement with Barcelona. So I don't think there will be hostile bids. It intrigues me. A friend of mine pointed this out yesterday. There's been lots of talk over the last few days about Victor Valdes saying, well, I don't know if I'll renew my contract, and who knows if maybe I wouldn't rule out trying another league. And I start thinking, ooh, I wonder if Victor Valdes is going to Bayern Munich. But then why would you when you've got Neuer, who I think is brilliant? So no, I don't think he will take Barcelona players, but I think he will want to impose a couple of players of his liking. And another colleague of mine last night made the interesting suggestion: does this throw a spanner in the works in terms of Barcelona's pursuit of Neymar?
Well, that is interesting. Sasamoa with a pretty interesting question himself. Can we ask Sid, how real is the possibility of Diego Simeone turning up at Stamford Bridge now that Guardiola has gone to Bayern?
Wow, that is a good question. To be honest with you, it's not one I'd even contemplated.
He'd whip him into shape, wouldn't he?
Well, he would, except, I don't know, Chelsea fans will tell us, I suppose, whether whipping them into shape is necessarily what they need or necessarily what Abramovich is looking for. It seems, doesn't it, over the last few years that Abramovich has been desperate for this kind of, if you like, this kind of mythical idea of pretty football. And Simeone's been brilliant at Atletico Madrid, but fundamentally he's made them aggressive and intense and very, very competitive. And I don't know if that's really what Abramovich is looking for. I personally think he's done an astonishingly good job at Atletico Madrid, partly because the conditions have been right for him. You know, he's gone into a club where he can unite people in a way that nobody else could have done. And Atletico Madrid has been socially and politically a real mess over the last few years, and Simeone has kind of managed to overcome that. So, it's a good question. I don't think so, but I wouldn't necessarily rule it out. I think the logical money would be on Mourinho going to Chelsea.
Sid Lowe in Spain. Philippe, I've got questions and love for you.
Do you?
Right, here's the plus one, a question for Philippe Auclair. What do you think is the perception of PSG among Europe's best players? Where does it rank for a rising star looking to move compared to Chelsea, the two Manchester clubs and the two major Spanish clubs?
Very high.
Yeah? Do you think this Falcao...
No, have you seen the kind of money they're offering?
Yeah.
That's the only reason why.
But, you know, when you look at Ibrahimovic, who's kind of like very, very big fish...
Do you know how much it costs PSG per season? Once you take into account social security payments and everything.
Yeah.
Have a guess.
To what? To have Ibrahimovic?
What it costs to have Ibrahimovic per season to PSG. Not just his wages, because it's net wages.
Right.
But also in France, you've got social security... employer's tax, which is absolutely massive.
Right.
So something 70, 75 million?
Plus new park car
over 80
car
million.
Over 80.
Over 80 million euros a year.
Wow.
I meant pounds, so I'll claim that.
Yeah, no, you can claim it. You can right. claim it. So, yes,
Owen,
it's very
would you
attractive.
Like to guess?
I'm saying about 80 million
euros. There you go. Yeah. Fantastic. And what about, so are they going to add Falcao to that?
They're talking about adding absolutely everybody. It's one of those silly moments. I mean, right. Leonardo is after everyone.
Right.
This issue of tax, one of the things I hadn't realised...
We should be clapping, by the way. The French public should be supporting PSG for bringing so much money into public coffers.
That's true. When Kevin Keegan left Liverpool to go to Hamburg, one of the main reasons was the 80-odd% tax rate that was in Britain at the time. He just said there's no point earning lots of money in Britain because... it all disappears.
Right.
The 75% tax thingy has been deemed anti-constitutional and will be re-examined in the autumn, so we don't know what's going to come out of that. There might be a climb down from Monsieur Hollande.
So okay. PSG are basically having to play net in order to compete with...
Yeah, it's like in Italy, which actually makes most of the highest earners in football pieces complete nonsense. Because they never tell you whether it's net or gross. And in Italy, it's and France, it's net.
Yeah.
In England, it's gross.
Oh, right. Some would say.
So to speak.
Everywhere. Right, here's someone with a gross name, which I can't read out in French. But he says, would you have Monsieur Auclair wax lyrical about my beloved Saint-Étienne, who have just made it to the final
of the Coupe de la Ligue?
That's absolutely right.
Yeah, the club is... I just hope for them that they're going to be able to hold on to their best player, Mr. Aubameyang. It's not going to be easy. And they're going to meet Rennes, who are going to be in the League Cup final for the first time in their history and beat Montpellier 2-0, which prompted a peaceful but very joyful pitch invasion.
What kind of pitch invasion? Peaceful but very joyful?
Yeah. No, it was peaceful, joyful. Oh. They were just so happy.
Right.
There were no incidents.
Right. Where was this?
In Rennes.
Oh, in Rennes. Okay. Yeah. Good.
Am I right in saying Patrice Carton?
They Rennes on the... No, stop.
Patrice Carton.
Played for Saint-Étienne?
Yes, you're quite right.
He's now Marley coach.
How about that?
Yeah, I think he's the only player to have scored in the Tanwir derby ever to have managed a team in the Cup of Nations.
How about that?
A little bit of history we can all enjoy.
Dom Tal, from all the way over in Australia, if I'm not mistaken, says, I have a question for Philippe. Is Yann Nvillar any good? Or, no, sorry, is he as good or better than Francis Coquelin? If he is substantially better, do you think there is another reason Wenger has not purchased him in recent years?
In terms of raw talent, he's superior to Francis Coquelin.
Right.
He's a similar type of player because, right. You would imagine him as a screening midfielder, but what he is very dynamic, very quick, very good positioning, and also has got this great sense of the first pass to the attacker. He's very, very good and very quick at that. Unfortunately, the Yann Nvillar I'm talking about is the one from about two seasons ago, like the one we saw at Wembley with Gourcuff and Nasri beating England. And since then, it's been going down, 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 down. He was playing for Rennes, by the way, in that victory over Montpellier.
Okay.
It wasn't particularly brilliant, but he was playing in there.
And is he going to QPR?
Listen, Loic Remy going to QPR really took my breath away because I thought that's impossible. Anybody in their right frame of mind would never go to Rangers, but he did.
Right.
They can afford, the money is huge. I'm hearing that there are problems, actually not with the player, but Rennes is not looking too happy to deal with QPR at the moment.
Oh.
But nothing that money can't sort out, I'm sure.
Okay, all right. Newcastle, who got a bit jilted by Remy there, they've been linked with Valencia left-back Gaetan-Bong. Wow, yeah. It's his name. It's not nice to...
Well, they're desperately looking for a left-back, aren't they?
Right.
Desperately looking for full-backs. But they already got... They by the way, everybody was talking about Remy, but they did a really good piece of business with Debussy.
Right. He's good, yeah?
Oh, yes.
All right.
It's excellent.
Well, the new look QPR featuring the upfront stylings, perhaps, of Loic Remy will be at West Ham this weekend, and that'll be featuring in our special Premier League preview coming up after Jonathan has his say on the Africa Cup of Nations after this. Jonathan Wright, well, Africa Cup of Nations, you're off today. Wow, I bet you're excited.
Yes, I am. It's most fun I have, to be honest, Cup of Nations.
Okay, lots of people posting in with questions for you. Here's Oliver King. What makes the Ivory Coast such massive favourites in such an unpredictable competition?
Got the best players by a significant margin.
Right.
There's this golden generation of Ivorian players, led by Drogba, then the Toure brothers, Eboué, Zakora. Zakora apparently is going to be wearing Maestro on his shirt, which seems
as a name.
Both arrogant and wrong. yes, as a name.
Is that his nickname? Or?
Yeah, apparently, yeah. Great generation of Ivorian players.
Right.
But they... Yeah, we keep saying this is our last chance.
Mm.
And they've been in Last Chance Saloon for so long that it's a lock-in. It's a lock-in in Last Chance Saloon. But you do worry that they're haunted by previous failures. That they lost on penalties in the final in 2006 when Drogba missed a sitter with 10 minutes to go in normal time and then missed his penalty in the shootout against Egypt. But that was against the host, it was against Egypt, so sort of explicable. Got absolutely mullered by Egypt in the semi-final 2 years later, got beaten 4-1. Colatour, I would argue, hasn't been the same since he got destroyed by Amirzaki in that game. 2 years after that, they take the lead in the 89th minute of their quarterfinal against Algeria, concede to Majid Bouguerra in injury time, concede to Hamad Bouazza very early in extra time, and then extraordinarily flat for the rest of extra time, as if just sort of paralysed by the horror of yet another failure. Then a year ago, they got to the final again. Drogba missed a penalty with 20 minutes to go against Zambia, and sort of the tide of emotion behind Zambia sort of swept them away.
Right.
And Jovinho, I think a lot of his problems came from that shootout.
Really?
Well, there was 7-all in the shootout, and all 14 penalties had been scored. And the Ivorian bench clearly wanted Jovinho to go forward. And you've got to ask, why is a forward player, why is an attacking player not in your first seven?
Hmm.
And Jovinho clearly didn't want to go. And Colatoure starts forward, so sees the bench sort of signalling manically, turns back, and Jovinho's, almost literally hiding. So Colatoure then, having gone up once, has to go up again, misses. Went for Kalaba, could have won it for Zambia, he missed. And then Jovinho does have to go forward. I mean, I hadn't actually seen the footage of it till last week. I was in the stadium and everything, but you obviously don't see all the close-ups and everything. There's a moment when Drogba just sort of hugs Jovinho. You can see Jovinho almost shaking. And, of course, he misses, as was absolutely inevitable. and Sundu scores the winner. But yeah, I think logically everybody focused on Zambia and this great emotional triumph and the most emotional sporting event I've ever been to. I was literally standing in the press box weeping because it was just so extraordinary. But seeing the footage last week and seeing Drogba's face and seeing the face of Zahui, the coach, knowing he was going to get sacked, the horror on the Ivorian's face of, oh God, this has happened again. And you do wonder, if he didn't concede a goal in the tournament last time, and they'd gone in with a deliberately risk-averse approach to try and cut out any chance of anything going wrong, and it still went wrong. And you do wonder, if it comes to a crunch again, are those demons going to be dragging them back?
Jovinho has just scored twice for the Ivory Coast, hasn't he? They played that friendly against Egypt.
And 1-4-2, that's right.
4-2, less than a Traore as well. But the one thing that surprised me, I must say I had lost touch a little bit with that, is that the Ivory Coast is now coached by Sabri Lamouchi.
Bizarrely, yes.
That is one of the most left-field appointments I can ever think of. I mean,
for producer Ben, who's probably confused, why is that left-field?
Well, because I don't know. I was thinking that the idea was to get either a very experienced coach or an Ivorian, but Sabri Lamouchi is neither.
Yes, he had no coaching experience before.
Yeah.
And you put him into this situation where, I think you're absolutely right, what you need is somebody very experienced, very calm, who basically going to convince them, look, you're the best team, just win the thing. Forget you keep on messing it up. But you do think, for Drogba, having effectively won the Champions League on willpower alone, to do it again, would be lovely for him. And he deserves it, because whatever you think of him in a Chelsea shirt, however petulant he's been at times, as soon as he puts on an orange shirt, his personality changes and he does become this extraordinary statesman-like figure. He is the oldest player of the outfielders, of the great generation. He has been a great leader for them in the last, 2006, I think he became captain. He should win it. It would be absurd if he ended his career not having won it.
Just one or two other questions from listeners. Roy of the Rovers, Jack's brother, says, what is the level of anticipation in South Africa for the tournament, given that they recently hosted the World Cup and have been patchy at best on the pitch since? Will the tournament be more affordable for locals than the World Cup was? Are you in a position to answer that, or should we come back to you when you're in South Africa?
That's probably come back to me.
Come back to you on that
one. It would be really interesting, though, to see what if anything has happened to football in South Africa since the World Cup.
That's one of the things I'll be looking at, but talk a bit about South African prospects on the pitch, but
are they realistic prospects for them?
Well, I think they are, and I think they are for two reasons, really. Three reasons. The first one is host overperform in the Cup of Nations since 1990, so if you take that as a benchmark of
it's when football started,
modernity,
more or less.
In terms of ease of air travel, mm-hmm. kind of homogeneity of pitches and things. 1990 is a useful cut-off. 17% of Asian Cups have been won by the hosts. 25% of Copa Americas have been won by the hosts. No Euros have been won by the hosts. And 44% of Cups of Nations. And that's despite CAF taking it outside of the traditional heartlands of African football to places like Equatorial Guinea, Gabon, or Mali, or Angola. So home advantage is massive.
And all the more significant, as it's played every 2 years or every year, it seems, these days.
Yeah, I mean, that's a significant sample size. Mm. So that's one thing in South Africa's favour. The second thing, I think the Mandela factor actually does make a big difference. That in 1996, when South Africa hosted it for the first time, they won it for the first and only time. And although everybody thinks back to the Rugby World Cup, which had happened 6-7 months earlier, and the great emotional moment of Mandela in the South Africa shirt handing over the trophy to Francois Pienaar, actually, I think for most South Africans, the much more poignant, much more significant moment was Mandela in the South Africa football shirt handing over the trophy to Neil Covey. Again, handing it over to a white captain. But the football team was genuinely mixed race. And I think football is the sport of the masses in South Africa. It is, traditionally, it was the black sport. So I think that in many ways was more meaningful, as this is an example of a racially harmonious group doing it for South Africa. Now, clearly things have changed fairly significantly since then. But Mandela out of hospital now, the thought that he could somehow be dragged out to the stadium again for the final to again present the trophy in whatever invalided condition he's now in, I think that is a great motivation. And the third thing, I think they're actually, although their results haven't been great, they're playing pretty good football. Gordon Nickerson's come in. He's the most successful coach in South African Premier League history. He's won it with four different clubs, so nobody else has done. They don't score many goals, but they've looked very neat, very tidy in midfield. And I don't think it would take much to spark that into very good form. And I think home advantage might be the thing that sort of carries them with that. And also, I just don't think there's many great team set. I think the Ivorians are a very, very good team. Other than that, it's a very open field.
Nigeria?
Nigeria back there, having missed out last time. I think Stephen Keshi, who I like a lot as a coach, he amuses me, which maybe is not the best reason to like a coach, but he's very aggressive. He knows his own mind and he doesn't brook criticism. I mean, the first time I ever saw him was in Cairo in 2006, and Emmanuel Adebayor had just moved from Monaco to Arsenal, and he hadn't started the game against DR Congo, the first game that Togo played. He was Togo coach at the time. He hadn't started that first game for Togo, and so I was, oh, I wonder if he's injured. I went, happy story here. We wandered down to the mixer, and the first thing we see is Steve Keshi on the team bus, and he's quite short and stocky. He's probably only about 5'10", which for centre-back as he was is short. Holding Adebayor by the throat with his fist pulled back, teammates pulling him apart. So he's a man who is aggressive in pursuing his own goals, should
right.
we say.
Okay.
And he's dropped Obafemi Martins, he's dropped Chelo Amiobi, he's dropped Peter Odemwingie. He's sort of made Mikkel John Obi buckle down. You do it his way. And in Nigeria, where there's so much political pressure, where the media is puts extraordinary pressure on the team, I think to have somebody that single-minded is a huge advantage for them. Their group, within with Zambia, Burkina Faso and Ethiopia, but I think their game in Zambia is probably the most interesting tie of the first round.
All right. What about Ethiopia and their road to the finals?
Well, I mean, they beat the old rival Sudan on away goals, which was a huge thing for them. They're back, they're one of the traditional powers of African football, back for the first time since 74.
Big coffee nation?
Yes, they are a big coffee nation, right. Yeah. Well, yes, it's all power to them.
Right, okay. And Togo, they have called up Adebayor.
And he has gone, which is good. I mean, it is Adebayor plus 10 others, I think. But
right.
I mean, it's just good he's gone. The shooting in Angola hasn't permanently turned him off the Cup of Nations. I think it would have been a tragic thing anyway, but that would have been an awful after effect.
Right, okay.
Remind me, Jonathan, who is not there? So Egypt is not there.
Cameroon.
Egypt and Cameroon.
And Senegal.
Senegal, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right, gosh. And Norway.
yes.
Right. Well, this it all kicks off with South Africa against Cape Verde, or Capo Verde. Right, what should we look out for, early matches that we should particularly keep an eye on? What will you be going to this weekend?
Well, I'll be at that opening game. It's a doubleheader, right. So there's that game followed by Angola v Morocco.
Ooh.
Then I'm heading down to Port Elizabeth to see Ghana and their group, the first two games.
Right.
And then I go to Rustenburg again, renewing old acquaintances with the Tombstone Shops of the High Street. Spending one night there. That was
you had a rueful grin on your face there, right?
Just haunted by memories of Rustenburg.
Right.
Actually, I'm sorry, I shouldn't be flippant about the Tombstone Shops, because the main street, there's four enormous Tombstone emporiums. And I was very flippant about it at the time, and then I sort of asked why this was. And it's actually horrifying. It's because the mortality rate from AIDS is so high.
Jeepers.
That death is sort of fetishized. That how do you make sense of a life that ends in somebody's teens or 20s? You don't, but you can somehow compensate by having an enormous tombstone, and funerals become big business.
Right.
So it'll be fascinating to see what's happened to that stadium as well, because it's not even it's nowhere near the town either. It's just literally in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, just in that sort of dusty field.
Yeah, it's bizarre.
And there's that Bafokeng Trauma Centre sign just outside.
All right.
Great days.
we watched Japan beat Denmark in Rustenburg. Memorably.
Yes, I was there, yeah.
Right.
Anyway.
Fabulous stuff. Well, Jonathan, good luck, Jonathan, as
Thank
they
you.
Say in Nigeria. And we look forward to hopefully catching up with you on your travels there in the Cup of Nations.
Yes, please do.
Well, all that's left for us now is to return to, parochial old Premier League, which got some...
No.
Oh, what?
I really want to talk about Guardiola.
From back then in part two. Go on then.
Well, it's because...
Yes?
There are several reasons for that.
Mm-hmm. For what?
Because I'm a bit annoyed at the way it's covered.
Oh, right.
Okay. Because you had those stories which were not stories, based on this video message, which was basically, I love you, England, for
yes.
the 150th anniversary of the FA Foundation. Which everybody, it's actually not the journalists, but the editors and sub-editors who decided to make it big.
Precisely, one of my editors, I won't say who, forced me to write the story. And I sort of said, I think this is madness. I just don't know why we're reporting him being polite on the occasion of the FA's 150th birthday.
Correct me if I'm wrong, he never mentioned the words Premier and League in his message.
I hope... Some point in the future...
It was suitably vague. I mean, it was so vague, I would almost have been tempted to read it the other way, but...
Yeah. And then you've got things like Guardiola delivers snub to Chelsea, Abramovich left in the lurch. What load of nonsense.
But it's like saying I've snubbed France by going to South Africa this evening. It's ridiculous. I've taken an option.
Well, you have actually, sir.
I've taken an option that's available to me, but it doesn't mean I've necessarily snubbed the rest of the
world. And also, Chelsea saw this coming from a long way off, or certainly...
Well, they certainly should have done.
They should have done. Maybe they didn't, knowing Chelsea. But
oh, I forgot to mention,
and I know Rafi,
while we're on the subject of this, just a quick mention for...
Yes.
Where is it? Here we go. Just on the subject of Guardiola, actually, Sayings McSaying, my yellow card is at the ready for the first Podder. To give it the pep was never going to go to Chelsea because they change managers too often. Noting, of course, that Hollywood FC have had 6 head coaches, stroke managers, in the last 5 years.
Yeah, just a few observations on Mr. Guardiola. He doesn't speak a word of German. Big
yet.
Problem. So
yep.
He's going to have to do a Van Gaal.
Right.
I think went into a monastery for something like 6 weeks and had an intensive
That's
course.
That's a documentary I would love to have seen.
It's extraordinary. This first thing. Second thing, I have a question, and it will have to be asked to Rafi when you next have him.
All right.
And to Sid. Is the prospect of Guardiola finding Mourinho in front of him in the Premier League, as he probably would have done if he had chose an English club, is it something that played on his mind? Because it really, really bugged him, didn't it?
And so actually, this is what Chelsea should do. They should offer an enormous amount of money to get Jurgen Klopp.
Yes.
And then encourage Dortmund to get Mourinho.
That's
and then that'll bring Guardiola to be available next year, and Chelsea can get him then.
Right.
And third thing, we're going to find out...
Yes.
Exactly, if Villanova was exactly 50% of Barcelona.
We certainly will, or even more than 50%, given how brilliantly they're doing
Absolutely.
With Villanova this season. Now, I'm just going to belatedly get on to the fact that there are some big games in the Premier League this weekend. I've already mentioned West Ham QPR, bottom of the table QPR, who are on a bit of a run. They've now beaten Chelsea, drawn with Spurs without conceding. Then they had a cup midweek over West... then they had a cup win midweek over West Brom as well. They're still 5 points adrift, but this new plan of actually buying new players in, could that turn the tide for the moment?
It's interesting how last January they went through the extraordinary contortions of buying some players in. I suppose they did survive by the skin of their teeth, didn't they? But I mean, Harry sounded so jaunty the other night that he ended his Five Live interview by humming the Sports Report theme tune, which we've all done. But it was a quite extraordinary way to evade questions about potential transfer targets.
All right, well, we don't have too long. So West Ham, who've only had 2 wins in their past 12 in all competitions, may have Andy Carroll fit. Are they going to wipe that smile off Harry's face?
I don't think they will. I mean, I think a draw is most likely. But I think that also that, West Ham had their good period, didn't they? And now they're going through a bit more of a tricky time.
Right.
Well, QPR are just benefiting almost from the pressure being off, that Harry's first 7 games were all against either teams in the bottom 8 or teams whose form was slightly wobbly, like Liverpool and West Brom. And sort of was pressure to win those games. And now this 7 games, you've got to play all of the top 4. They've got a couple of difficult away games. You wonder if it's almost... It doesn't really matter, we're already down.
Right.
And that produces this freedom. I mean, I hate to bring it back to Sunderland, as you know, but Sunderland 76-7 were almost relegated, having only won 2 games by December, and suddenly started playing brilliant football through January, February, and were only relegated by the cheating of Jimmy Hill.
Right. Well, Sunderland, anyway, have got themselves out of danger. For the moment, 4 wins in their last 8, they've moved up to 6 points clear, although they did lose to Bolton in the Cup.
Yeah, that's the worrying thing. They're so inconsistent. I mean, they're apparently very, very good in beating West Ham last week.
Right.
But apparently awful against Bolton.
Well, they're going to be at Wigan. Of course, Wigan, who are just goal difference outside the bottom 3.
Yeah, Sunderland won very convincing there last season, scored 4 in part of that Martin O'Neill bounce. I don't know, I can't tell with Sunderland. They've been very odd this season.
What about the team that's taking their place in the bottom 3, Villa then, who are only facing their neighbours West Brom? Yikes.
Yeah, I think...
Good face from Philippe. It was like you stepped in something.
Well...
You're not excited by this
one. Well, excited wouldn't be the word.
No.
Intrigued, rather, because I'm also trying to understand what's happening to West Brom exactly.
Just 2 wins in their last 7.
Yeah.
So they'll be looking forward to facing Villa.
All that's happened to West Brom is regression to the mean. I mean, this happens every season. A team starts well. But come November, December, they're kind of in the top 6, top 7. Everybody sort of goes, this is brilliant. They have a new great side and they're going to be a new force. And actually... come the end of the season, they've lost to games that other teams interspersed more evenly. Yep.
You're right. I mean, they're now losing the games that they, you know, they're not playing that much worse. Reading. Actually, they, you know, against Reading, they play pretty well for 80 minutes. You know, but they're losing the games that they were winning early in the season.
All right. So Villa, is that a game they're going to lose? West Brom at home?
I don't think so. No. I think Villa are looking pretty.
What one point from the last five games?
Oof. And how about
the goals conceded is phenomenal.
48, I think. Is that right?
Of late.
In those five games, I see. Yeah.
Of late, yes.
We win 8 against Chelsea, 4 against Tottenham.
Yeah. It's
a lot of goals. Mm-hmm. Newcastle Reading, that's a six-pointer.
It is.
Newcastle are only 2 points off the drop. Reading have moved up to 3 points off safety with that extraordinary comeback win against West Brom. Debuchy has already made his debut. It wasn't that convincing, a lot of people felt. Is that right?
I give him a break.
Give him a chance.
Exactly. It's just
I'm just rushing Lemmy Light to over judgment.
Okay. Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. So, but yeah, he's a talent. Newcastle at home to Reading, Bosch, eh? Hey, wow. Reading have made some signings. Hope Akpan from Crawley Town. Yeah, they're going first for him. Fulham right back Stephen Kelly and Sporting Lisbon's former captain, Daniel Carrico.
They have made some signings.
There you are. Yep. Those are those signings in full. Kapai is on his way back for Newcastle. It's all looking good for the Toon.
Yes, indeed. Mm. No, there shouldn't be too much of a problem for the Toon, should it?
Right, home to Reading. You'd think not.
They need those players back desperately. They need to buy a couple of players as well in this window, don't they?
The only thing with that game is if they didn't win that, there really would be panic and alarm bells and whatever happens when you panic. Right. And whether that then applies a level of pressure, whether that's... Yeah. You can imagine, even if Newcastle start well but don't score,
right.
You can imagine the atmosphere at St James after half an hour being incredibly twitchy.
Yeah.
One thing we haven't mentioned, I mean, I know it's probably going to be to get cut completely with the African Cup of Nations bit.
Yeah.
We haven't mentioned at all the impact it would have on domestic competitions.
Well, no, weeks and weeks we've been talking about the players who for example, Man City without Yaya Touré.
Yeah.
Although last year they won 4 out of 5 without him.
You are no fun, Jonathan, really. They're home to Fulham.
Interesting thing is like when people say when a major player is missing, when Fellaini was
suspended. Yeah.
Everton won their first two games when he was suspended and probably should have won the third against Chelsea.
Rooney out for Man United.
People say, if Fellaini out, they haven't got a chance.
All right, well, Aguero's coming back for Man City and they're at home to Fulham. They've won 7 of their last 8 in all competitions. Company's come back because his red card's been rescinded. So I'm going to move straight onto a Swansea Stoke. Or am I going to regret that, do you think, Owen, when Fulham spring the surprise of the season?
No.
All right, Swansea Stoke.
Well, I was at Fulham on Saturday, and they're lovely in possession, and they're all over the place out of possession. I mean, Brian Ruiz was playing at the back of midfield. Damien Duff was the most defensive player in the midfield.
Playing at the back of midfield? What, is it like the holding midfielder?
Yeah. But, I mean, I presume it's down to kind of absences rather than design, but they're like a flaneur. They just sort of wander through games and sort of every now and again do something
like
brilliant.
A what? Certain bit of nonchalance, perhaps.
A flaneur?
Well, you know, a hat at a naughty angle.
Jaunty.
Jaunty.
Right.
You know.
They're jaunty, Jonathan.
Yeah,
I guess. Okay.
Cigarette
holder. Did you use a Scott Murray word? They are jaunty.
Spats, this sort of thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Love a bit of that.
They're the Bertie Woosters of English football.
Right. Good. Now, Liverpool Norwich, they beat them 5-2 at Carrow Road. Come on, they're going to roll all over them at Anfield, are they?
No, I don't think so.
Are they not?
Well, Norwich looking pretty solid now, aren't they? You know, they're this different Norwich team to the one they beat at Carrow Road. I mean,
it's a Norwich that's got 1 point in their last 5, and that came at home to Newcastle.
But that point at which Liverpool won, that was the point of false dawn for Rodgers as well, wasn't it? Yeah. Everyone decided it suddenly clicked and all the rest of it, and so it hasn't done. I mean, I think Liverpool will win, but I don't think it'll be a... I don't think it'd be easy for them.
SAS, Suarez and Sturridge.
Indeed. Well, they looked much better once Sturridge came on, didn't they, against United?
SAS, Swansea and Stoke.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Clash of styles there.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very nice. Love a bit of acronym. Yeah.
Guardiola FCB to FCB.
Oh, yeah, very good.
Well, we could carry on like that.
Yeah.
What was that? FCB to FCB, sorry.
Hey.
Yeah. I thought it was chess notation or something.
What have you done with Jonathan Wilson? right, that's it then for today. Although, if you're excited to hear more about newspapers saying silly things about Guardiola, there might be one or two in our special Friday morning Euro paper roundup. Otherwise, you can hear the thoughts of, or you can read the thoughts of Sid and Raphael online at guardian.co.uk, and the thoughts of Owen Gibson as well on the FA's marvellous 150th Jamboree.
Which I'm pleased to say we didn't have time to talk about because it doesn't really bear much scrutiny.
150 years. The oldest FA.
We've got the rest of the year to talk about it.
First ever game played on FA Laws was Barnes v Richmond, which is a 0-0 draw. Coincidentally, my first ever game of Barnes Hockey Club was against Richmond.
Wow. I don't think that is coincidence. That's something bigger than coincidence. Very good.
We lost 1-0.
Many thanks, Owen Gibson. Many thanks, producer Ben, Philippe Auclair and Jonathan Wilson. And have a super time in South Africa. Enjoy your weekend, listeners. We'll be back on Monday.